Right, so I'd also like to thank the organizers for the opportunity to speak here. I'm gonna be talking, I'm trying to move this over here so that I don't look in the light. I'm gonna be talking today mostly about a series of experiments we've done over the years on drag and penetration force in granular materials. This has been going on for 5 or 6 years now, and so I had a whole series of students and postdocs and a few senior collaborators help out with along the way. And the problem that we really are trying to address is something which Stefan Kohler talked a little bit about previously, a couple days ago, and which I've stolen one of Bob Berenger's pictures to try to illustrate, is what happens when you push something through a dense granular pack. In other words, if I try to push something, I push on a dense granular pack, or I try to push something through, how does that object move through? And in particular, what we can think of is if I push on the top of a granular pack, that creates a structure of force chains, it creates a jammed state, and then what is the nature of that jammed state resulting from the locally applied stress, and how strong is the state, and how will it fail? If I push hard enough, the object will go through. How does that happen? How do the grains rearrange themselves? And what we started out studying was the drag force, the granular drag force. And the simple picture of this is that you go to the beach, and just a short walk away, you stick your finger in the sand, and you pull it horizontally. And there will be a drag force just as if you're sitting in your bathtub and you pull it horizontally. And this drag force comes about, like I said before, from the fact that you have to rearrange the grains. You apply stress to the grains. You have to rearrange them in order for your object, in this case your finger, to move through. And the way that stress propagates is through these force chains that Bob has so nicely made pictures of for us. Now, the idea of granular drag, and this is at low velocities, where we're not going through very fast, we're just moving slowly through the grains, is that the grains jam and then the jam states break. And so what you'd expect the force as a function of time to look like is it would build up, and then as the jam state collapses, you'd get a drop in the force, build up and drop, so on. So you'd get this sort of stick slips type motion, and the drag force would be the average of that. And since the drag force is arising from the sort of frictional type behavior, you'd expect it to be independent of the velocity as you pull your object through. Now, if I have a cylinder, so imagine your finger is a cylinder, a vertical cylinder being pulled through the grains, you would expect just from very simple calculation that the drag force would be proportional to the diameter of the cylinder, the depth of the cylinder is inserted in the grains squared, and then some fudge factor up front, eta, gravitational acceleration, and rho, which is just the density of the grain material. And the way we measured this was we just took a bucket of grains and we rotated it, and as we rotated it, we stuck a cylinder in and held that cylinder fixed, and then measured the force needed to hold it fixed. The force needed to hold it fixed is equivalent to the drag force. And we measured this under a lot of different conditions, different cylinders, different grains, different velocities, and so on. And what we found was very good agreement in the average drag force, and very good agreement with this expected mean field expression. So the force is proportional to the depth squared. It's proportional to the cylinder diameter. It does not depend, this is something Stefan pointed out also in his talk, it does not depend on the grain diameter. As long as your object is much larger than the grain size, the drag force doesn't depend on the diameter of the sphere. These are spherical glass beads. It doesn't depend on the diameter really at all. It also doesn't depend on the velocity. And these are different runs, different size beads, different cylinders, and you can see it really, the drag force really doesn't depend on the velocity. And just for comparison, this is what you'd expect for fluid drag. And so you'd expect a very strong velocity dependence, of course, for a fluid. Here you really don't see any. And we also see I won't talk about it really today, but we also see very strong fluctuations in the drag force corresponding to the grains jamming and then the jam states breaking, jamming again, the jam states breaking. Now, the thing which we found quite surprising is that the drag really didn't depend much on the surface of the object or even the shape of the object that we were pulling through. So we had cylinders with very different coefficients of friction, and the drag force was pretty much the same for all of them. And we also tried dragging, for example, a whole cylinder as opposed to half cylinder, where we just cut the cylinder in half along the vertical axis, had the flat face going into the grains, and we got essentially the same drag force. Not only did we get the same drag force, but we got the same fluctuation spectrum in the drag. And so really what's going on here is that there's a bulk jam state being created by pushing the object through, that those jam states, the bulk states, are collapsing over and over again. So it's not something that's happening at the surface of the object that's going through. It's really the larger state of the granular material that's collapsing. Now, one thing that we found sort of curious was that our fluctuations, and I won't talk in detail about, seemed to depend on the size of the container and the depth to which we stuck the cylinder in. And so we started looking at the finite size effect on the granular drag. And the way we did this was by not pulling something horizontally, but rather pushing something in vertically. And in particular, trying to push a plate down in a bucket of grains toward the bottom and see how the penetration force changed as we approached the bottom. So it's a very simple apparatus, a penetrometer. And the soil physicists use these things, much more complicated versions, to measure soil. But the basic idea is we pushed it in and measured the force. That's a force cell there. We measured the force as a function of depth as we went into the grains. And we varied the bucket size and the size of the grains and basically every parameter we could. And one thing I'd like to point out is that in these experiments we found, after struggling for a long time getting results that were somewhat inconsistent, we found that it was very important to prepare the granular sample the same way every time and to get a consistent packing fraction. And the way we did this was by essentially having a hopper that would allow the grains to flow, and then it would slowly lower the bucket that we were going to do the penetration experiment in, just lowering it very slowly, so we would get a homogeneous and reproducible packing fraction every time. Because if we had an inhomogeneous packing fraction, then the results would be rather inconsistent. That's a great question. We don't make it flat, actually. So we actually focus entirely on what's going on at the bottom of the bucket, and so there's a little cone at the angle of repose at the top, that not quite exactly like that cone, but similar. But we essentially ignore the data at the very top of the bucket. And so these are sample raw data that we took, and so this is the force as a function of the height above the bottom of the bucket, and you can see that there are different regimes for the behavior. So near the top surface, you can see there's a little curve there, which is probably due to the fact that there's a conical shape at the top. There's a linear regime, sort of a hydrostatic regime, as you'd expect. As you go deeper and deeper, the pressure builds up. As you go deeper in, the kind of turns over, and that's because the walls start to support some of the weight of the grains, as you'd expect. And if you go close to the bottom, of course, the drag force starts to shoot up very quickly. And what we really wanted to study was what's happening as you get close to the bottom. So how close to the bottom do you start to feel that a bottom is there? And exactly in what way do you feel that it's there? Because as I start out near the top surface here, I can't really tell where the bottom is. You can see all these curves look the same. The question is, how close to the bottom do I start to feel that a bottom exists? And a problem you can see immediately is that there's this complicated shape to the data. So here's a single curve, and you can see there's a complicated shape to the data. And the question is, what is the effect of the bottom as opposed to just the intrinsic depth dependence of the penetration force? And the way we got around that is by measuring the depth dependence of the penetration force far from the bottom, then using that as a background, and then we would just subtract that off to get the intrinsic effect of the bottom. So let's see if we can get this to work. Yeah, so we just took the data with a very deeply filled bucket and then translated those data over and then used those data as a background to subtract off, and then we could see just the effect of the bottom. And this also allowed us to get a measure of the force, the penetration force, at the depth of the bottom, which gives us a measure of the stress state at the bottom of the bucket, which is hard to get otherwise. And we call that F naught, the force at the depth of the bottom of the bucket. And so now we can answer, how close to the bottom of the bucket can you feel that the bottom actually exists? And what we find is that there's a very well-defined length scale for feeling the bottom of the bucket. So if you look at the data, after you subtract off the background, if you look at the data, you see that the delta F, the effect of the bottom of the bucket, has this very nice exponential relationship with the distance from the bottom of the bucket. And the exponential relationship implies there's a length scale, lambda, associated with feeling the bottom of the bucket. In other words, there is an intrinsic length scale to the jammed state that's collapsing that's associated with the penetration. And so there's been a lot of discussion of different length scales. Here's one that seems, that really flies out. I'll talk about that. It scales, the short answer goes like the square root of the size of the penetrometer. I'll show you the data in a second. And that's really the question. How does it compare with the pressure, the plate diameter, the grain diameter, other things? And so we studied that. And the first thing we found was that it is not affected at all by the grain size, which is quite surprising because, you know, there aren't that many grains in there. Our grain size is typically a millimeter or so, and the length scale is on order of 5 millimeters, but you can see that the length scale doesn't seem to be affected by the size of the grains. On the other hand, as Tom suggested, it is affected by the diameter of the plate that we're pushing in. And so you can see these are curves for different plate diameters, and you can see that the slope of the exponential is changing as you change the size of the plate. And as you'd expect, the bigger the plate you push in, the larger the length scale gets. It also changes, the length scale also changes depending on how high you fill the bucket. And this, again, you'd expect, because if you fill the bucket higher, you have more pressure. You have more pressure, higher pressure at the bottom of the bucket. And we get a measure of that pressure through this measurement of F naught, what the force would be at the depth of the bottom of the bucket if the bottom weren't there. You mean? This part here. Yeah, it's that part there. So this is on a log scale here, so the plunging down is a little bit, yeah, right. Basically, yes. This minimum here, the fact that it actually goes, the delta F goes negative here, the difference goes negative there, comes about because we had a smooth bottom to the bucket. And so for lack of time, I wasn't going to show the data, but as you approach the smooth bottom, it's actually for some range of distances, it's actually easier to push through the grains than if you didn't have a bottom there at all, because the grains can slide along the smooth bottom. So it's actually easier when you're close to a hard bottom if the bottom is smooth for some small range here. But so the data, the exponential is this part of the curve. And so when we put our parameters in, we find that the length scale corresponds to, it seems to scale with the square root of F naught over R, where F naught again is the force needed to push through at the depth of the bottom if the bottom weren't there. And you can see that these are data taken for a bunch of different grain sizes, different both circular and square plates, and you can see it works pretty well. I can show the data also. These are the data I showed you before for the different plate sizes, round plates, and for different fill heights and pressures. And you can see if we scale the data to this F naught, square root of F naught over R, and scale the delta F, the change in the force, to F naught. I'm sorry? Time scales. G. So you can put in a factor of rho G, and then that'll come out. So it seems to scale, all these data seem to collapse pretty nicely onto a single exponential. And this is about as far as we can get, and I'm hoping that some of the very bright theorists here will jump in and say that they know exactly where it's coming from, because we've been unable to so far. We get the length scale goes like this. Now, if you say that F naught is some effective pressure times the area of the plate, then you could change this to say that lambda is proportional to the pressure, square root of pressure times the radius. And if you put in a rho g in the bottom there, the units come out all right. But where exactly this comes from is not clear. It seems to be robust. We get it for real sand. We get it for rough bottoms and smooth bottoms, all sorts of different things. But we don't see exactly where it comes from a theoretical standpoint. So it would be very interesting if someone could come up with a good theory for it. Now, the next thing we wanted to look at, one thing. How am I doing for time? 5-10 minutes? Okay. So we want to look exactly what this length scale means, and what we've been trying to do now is image exactly what's going on in a bead pack. And this is something which is just underway, and Wolfgang Loser is doing something similar, which hopefully he'll have a chance to talk about after lunch. But I don't know if you can see here, but this is an MRI image of a plunger going through. This is through mustard seeds, and you can see there's the plunger there, and you can see the grains are moving around it. And so we're trying to get an image of exactly how the grains move as an object goes through. And you can see there's complicated motion. Right in front there's some motion. I don't know how well it shows up, but there's also motion sort of circulating around. So this is a complicated flow field. And again, hopefully we'll be able to come up with some good model for this. So every once in a while, there's sort of the whole system seems to relax, and that's when the guy took a weekend, and basically the whole system relaxed a little bit. So there's a long time lag between images there. But what this is just a series of MRI images. Each MRI image takes, I think, half hour to acquire. Exactly. Exactly. So, plunge it, move it down a little bit, take a picture, move a little more, take a picture, move a little more, take a picture. So it's not quite analogous to the experiment. Plastic. It has to be for the MRI. And that also might be relaxing a little bit. All right, so, if I can get it to... There we go. Whoops. Okay, so... I want to talk just real briefly about two experiments that we have ongoing now. The next thing is we want to look at, since boundaries are interesting, is look at the effect of a free boundary. And this is, the sort of nightmare of being buried alive, right? And the question is, how much force do you need to lift the lid off if you have a free surface?
How do you find it to get ready?
Well, they call this the coffin experiment, so they have a good sense of humor about it, happily. And apparently, people who are particularly afraid of this, which probably includes a lot of us, are called taphophobic. So Matt Stone, the postdoc who started this, looked that up for me. New apparatus, and the idea is basically just to invert the old experiment, which is to have a plate built into the bottom of a bucket and push up on it. Push up on the plate and then measure the force needed to push up through the grains. And again, we very careful to get a reproducible, clean, homogeneous filling factor to make sure that we can reproduce the data. And we start with the plate flush with the bottom, so it's a nice clean surface that we're pushing up through. And the data we get, the raw data, looks something like this. And I should mention that we're pushing on a spring also. There's some elasticity to the pushing as we push up, which is why, if you look at the data, there's sort of an initial, you see there's an initial rise as you push up, and then as the object, as the plate lifts from the bottom of the surface, it and grains flow underneath it, there is a rapid movement of the plate, and then it starts going up again. And so you can see there are two points here I want to emphasize in particular. First is this initial breakout, that there's sort of some force you need to initially move from the bottom. And then there's another point here where the grains flow under the rising plate, and the plate moves up quickly after that. And the thing that's striking about these data, and again, I should emphasize these are preliminary data, but I feel pretty confident in this statement, is that these data depend very strongly on the grain diameter. So all of our other data and the horizontal drag force and the penetration, that was independent of the grain diameter. These data depend very strongly on the grain diameter. You can see these are equivalent sets of data for different size grains. You can see the curves look very different. And in particular, the point where the grains flow under the plate depends on the grain size. And so that's this point here. And you can see these are data for different size grains. And you can see that the force that you need to get to that point depends very much on the size of the grains. And this kind of makes sense because you need a bigger crack to let the bigger grains underneath. So it kind of makes sense that you'd get a different force to push it up a little bit higher. Yeah.
and it's behind the scenes, and I don't want to look at lightning in the top. And we really need to talk about the increase of motion where, of course, the bottom is just front of the wall.
Yeah, so I mean, in some sense, here we want to, we're looking at the surface effect. So, I mean, we're. Absolutely. It's the usual thing where that was the initial goal and we want to get there, but then we realized we didn't understand what was happening just as we got started. So, we do want to get to the free surface, but it might be a little while.
Yeah.
The yes and no. If we did that, then it would be better. Except then that you'd have to worry about friction on the sides, because you end up having a reasonable amount of friction on the sides of the cylinder, and so we want to have a thin post pushing it up. Yes, yeah, but it's a comparable size. So. Let me show you the next slide before I answer that. If we look at just the breakout force, just the force you need to break through the surface, okay, so this is without any backfilling, that also depends very much on the bead diameter. And we've done this for a bunch of different size plungers now and different heights and so on. And this we don't understand at all. I mean, what this says is that if you're going to be buried alive, you'd rather be buried alive in pebbles rather than boulders, which maybe makes sense, but... We don't understand the physical basis for it, and why there's such a strong dependence on the bead diameter, and this is very, very different from our previous stuff. Okay. So now I'm going to talk. we give me 2 more minutes, or I started. He went a little bit long. I started. Give me 2 minutes. I just want to show these. This is something which is very new and which I think is relevant to a lot of things that were talked about this morning and then previous in the conference. This is something which we started looking. People talk about granular temperature a lot, and I'm actually a low temperature physicist by training. And we've started looking at what happens when you change the real temperature of the grains, you know, the actual thermodynamic temperature. And what we do is we actually ask what happens if you heat up and then cool down a granular sample. What happens is that the grains expand and then they contract again, and so they settle down, and that changes the packing fraction. And this can actually have drastic effects. So a grain silo, this actually wasn't a grain silo, a silo for something called fly ash, that apparently the ash settled and settled and settled, and then one very cold night the silo contracted and the whole thing burst. And that was the result. It's actually a serious industrial problem. But as far as we can tell, there's been no careful study of this. And so we started doing the measurements, and very simple measurements, this is not really a 19th century experiment here. You know, we took a cylinder, put it in the oven, warmed it up, cooled it down, and then measured the change in packing. And what we found is that you can get a clear and systematic change in the packing fraction. And you can see that, you know, as a function of temperature, the change in packing fraction goes up. And you see it depends very little on the grain diameter. So it seems a very robust effect. It doesn't seem to depend on how high you fill the cylinder. It doesn't seem to depend very much on the diameter of the cylinder, as long as the cylinder is much larger than the grain diameters. These are glass beads. So glass beads in a plastic cylinder. And you can actually fit very well to a double exponential. So this is 30 cycles, heating, cooling, heating, cooling, heating, cooling. 30 cycles, and you can see you get a very nice exponential relaxation with 2 relaxation times. And it's very much analogous to the sort of vibrational methods for packing that people have been talking about, except in this case it's much gentler, right? We're not shaking and tossing the whole thing up. We're just letting it expand and contract. So it's a much gentler process. So it's the plastic expands a lot more than the glass. So plastic expands. So let me just put up my conclusion slide, and then I can answer that. So this is from the first part, and these are some questions here. The second part, the main thing I wanted to point out is the temperature could be an important parameter for granular media. I mean, it's a new way of studying packing, and the next experiment we want to do is put plastic beads in a glass cylinder, because then the beads will expand and the glass won't. And so presumably they'll sort of rise up and then settle down. Or break the glass. It'll be exciting in either case, right? And there's all sorts, there's a whole new set of parameter space to study. And I think in particular it's a new way of studying packing compared to the rather violent ways of, you know, tapping or shaking or blowing it, hot air through it. So anyway, thank you very much for your attention.
Just kind of again going, if you could show us the data again in the pushing up one, where and what happens near as you approach the surface with the different grain sizes.
Yeah, so this isn't approaching the surface, and this is really just the first few, this is the first centimeter and a half, and we fill it to 15 centimeters.
I'm wondering if near the surface actually all of those curves are going to get right on top of each other so that you will still have a result that's independent of grain size. That's what I was trying to see, but you're saying you're not even close to the
surface. Yeah, we're not even, we haven't, to be quite honest, we haven't looked at that in much detail yet because we figured we'd better understand this first.
In the experiments that you carried out before the first part of your talk, you said you were on 59% by volume. How significant is it for you to be essentially at the boundary between flows that must dilate and the flows that must contract?
Well, that's a great question. We don't have a good way of controlling the packing fraction, so this is what we could do homogeneously and reproducibly. Harry Sweeney's group is promising, now they have this way of, you know, blowing the air through and controlling the packing fraction. They've been saying they're going to reproduce it as a function, reproduce these measurements as a function of packing fraction. His postdoc, Matthias, I think is planning to, is actually planning to do the measurement. So we just don't know at this point, and hopefully they'll be able to give some answers. I just can't say for sure. I mean, we played with the packing a little bit, and what we found is that we couldn't do a good background subtraction unless we had reproducible packing, and every time we tried banging it or shaking it, we found that each time we would do a run under nominally equivalent conditions, we would get somewhat different data, and then doing that subtraction was very ugly.